Welcome to the latest United We Stand. My name's Andy Mitten and I'm delighted to welcome Terry Gibson as the guest on the podcast today. Terry's a London lad, played for Tottenham Hotspur, who are United's opponents on Sunday, for Coventry City 2, Wimbledon and Manchester United. He now works for Sky TV as a Spanish football correspondent. That's because he lived in Spain for a time and he was scouting for several Premier League clubs, so now he does the TV stuff. Welcome, Terry.
Good morning, Andy.
So you're a London lad, Tottenham fan, and you played for Tottenham?
Yeah, no, it was obviously, you know, I was at Spurs when I was a very young kid, and it was always a dream of mine to play for Spurs, and I never once thought it would materialise. Like most kids, you think it's a bit of an impossible dream, but I was fortunate enough to make my debut, get taken on as an apprentice, and within 3 months I started in the first team, and my second and third games were actually against Manchester United, and you know, it was an FA Cup match. We drew 1-1 at White Hart Lane. 3 days later we're travelling up to Old Trafford for a replay, and you know, I'm in the team. Mihailovic gets stretched off. It's quite a well-known game. Mihailovic got stretched off after a challenge with Joe Jordan. Glenn Hoddle went in goal, and obviously Ardiles got the winning goal and a 1-0 victory in extra time. And it was an unbelievable start to my career. First three games, I was 17 and 6 days when I made my first game against Stoke City in the league. And then in the next week, I'm playing at White Hart Lane against Manchester United and at Old Trafford against Manchester United. It was an unbelievable start to my career.
So that's the early 80s. That was at a time when Tottenham Hotspur actually had higher revenues than Manchester United and were arguably not a bigger club internationally, but plenty of players would have chosen Tottenham over Manchester United because they would have paid more money, for example. How were United perceived at that time?
Throughout my lifetime, Manchester United have been perceived, even when they wasn't winning league title after league title, as one of the biggest clubs in the country, if not the biggest club in the country. And it was, you know, it was always an easy sell to get a player to go to Manchester United, irrespective of the money. I don't think the money was a great issue back in those days because there was huge differences. Of course, there was differences between a top match for Manchester United and a Coventry, for instance, and a Wimbledon who I played for. But, you know, I wouldn't have thought there would have been too much difference between Liverpool, Manchester United, Tottenham and the bigger clubs at that time. So I think most players would love the opportunity to sort of play for Man United. It was the crowds, it was playing at Old Trafford, it was 60,000 people then, it was the standing at the Stretford then, and it really was a place that, you know, you either wanted to play for or go and play at Old Trafford. That's probably still the same now.
Paul Parker was offered more money to join Tottenham. Despite being a London lad, he went up to Old Trafford, was completely seduced by some of the points you mentioned, the stadium, Sir Alex Ferguson, and by the end of the afternoon, he just, yeah, where can I sign? He regrets that now because he didn't have an agent to negotiate a contract for him, but yeah. He just completely fell for the place.
I was exactly the same. I mean, I was aware of interest later in my career that Manchester United were interested in signing me, and this was from Coventry, and Tottenham wanted me back again. And it never got to serious negotiations with Tottenham, even though I'm a Tottenham fan. Manchester United came in, made an offer, and I couldn't wait to, same as Paul, I did have an agent, and I couldn't wait to get up there and sign.
Where are you from in London?
Walthamstow, which is north east London.
So that's a big Tottenham area?
It is, yeah, it's quite close. It's a mixture, really, of, I suppose, like most parts of London, it's mainly Tottenham, Arsenal, there's a little bit of West Ham and Leyton Orient.
Yeah, and a dog track.
And the dog track, yeah, which is still there, but not being used anymore, so.
What have you made of Tottenham this year?
I'm still frustrated, actually. I worry. You always do worry. I think we have a lot in common with Manchester City fans over the years, believe it or not. I think that we always expect the worst, and I think Manchester City have been like that prior to the new regime. But it's why the Tottenham supporters are. You know, we actually believe this year that we'll finish fourth and Arsenal win the Champions League this year. To happen last year with Tottenham, finish fourth, and Chelsea win the Champions League, and that means that Tottenham didn't qualify, was typical of Spurs, really. So I'm kind of frustrated that we haven't made the most of other teams and the poor form. And I think we've dropped points we shouldn't have done. But I'm relatively pleased with the appointment of Vilas Boas.
You won at Old Trafford. You played well. I know it was back to the walls in the second half, but you won at Old Trafford.
Yeah, and incredible. I think on their day, Tottenham, when all the players are fit, they do have some really top players.
Like who? Of course, Bale obviously.
Is the obvious one. I think Gareth Bale is as good as anything in the Premier League now. When he's on top form, I think he's not a million miles away from being as good as the top players in Europe now. I see Ronaldo play regularly for Real Madrid, and when he's on form, which is most weeks, he's unplayable. Lionel Messi is exactly the same, and I think to have an impact on a game, to be as effective as they are, I think Gareth Bale's head could be heading in the right direction. I think Old Trafford, he had one of those days as well, and he's, you know, the more he has, the better for him, the more better for Tottenham Hotspur. And of course, when Tottenham Hotspur have an awful record against Manchester United, so that was a real turn up, but you know, they're nice to get a league win at Old Trafford.
Bale's Real Madrid's number one target for this summer. You think he could do well at the Bernabeu? They think he'll be expensive. They were a little bit underwhelmed by the form of Modric since he's gone there. One Spanish paper described him as the biggest flop of the last transfer window. But they seem set and really keen to sign Bale.
They should be. I think he would really, really enhance their team. And I feel kind of sorry for Luka Modric. I don't know why they bought him up. That's the issue with me. When he's played, I think he's done well. And he's still settling into a new club, in their teammates in a new country and whatever. But every time I see him play, he's doing all right. I saw the same comments about him being voted the worst player of the season. I just don't see why Jose Mourinho was so desperate for him. 30-odd million, they should have saved it and put it towards Gareth Bale. And in the long term, for probably a player that, not that they need him, but would enhance their team. With Luka Modric, he's changed his position. He's playing, trying to get him to play just behind the striker. And they've already got Mesut Ozil and Kaká. So why on earth have you needed three players of that ability that cost that much money for one position? I don't know. So, but I think Gareth Bale is destined, you know, for real greatness now.
Real Madrid are playing Manchester United in the next round of the European Cup. Who do you think will win?
Manchester United.
Why?
I think if you do ask me a year ago, I think it might have been a different story altogether, but I think this year Manchester United are in good form. I think after suffering last season in the Champions League, not going through the group, after suffering against and losing the title to Manchester City, I think they've got all out this year to be really focused, determined and motivated to do as well as they can again. Real Madrid is the opposite. Last year, over Manchester United, they were not the underdogs, but they were trying to get the title back from Barcelona. And they were focused in every single game. This year, having won the league last year, their intensity, their focus, their motivation is just not there at all. And, you know, they're 18 points behind Barcelona at this halfway mark in La Liga, which is, it's incredible that Jose Mourinho is still there. Because other managers in the past have been maybe 1 or 2 points behind, that's been enough for the sack. They're going to find it hard, Real Madrid now, to turn that form on and off, and their form hasn't been great. In league matches, the run of results they've had in the league is ridiculous to some of the teams that they've lost. But I think the Manchester United have got the away advantage first, going to the Bernabeu. They'll know what they have to do at Old Trafford, I think. The secret for me for Manchester United is to avoid a disaster in the first half of the first game. And by that I mean, if Real Madrid get a sniff of being dominant in the first game, the tie against anybody could be over in 20 minutes, half an hour.
This happened.
You might easily find yourself 2 or 3 goals behind.
This happened when United played the last time in the Bernabeu. Madrid were exceptionally good in the first half, with Raul especially. And yeah. You mentioned Kaká. he destroyed United in the semi-final in 2007 when he played for Milan. They won 3-0 in the San Siro. United's defence had a poor time of it. Vidic had just come back from injury. Kaká was probably the best player in the world then. He certainly isn't now. He's having a terrible time. He got sent off against Osasuna. He's barely playing, and yet he's still the second most expensive player in the world. Has he been unfairly treated by Mourinho?
Yeah, definitely. I think we forget he's been there the same amount of time as Ronaldo, so they were both there the year before Jose Mourinho.
They're both on the same salary. They both signed very similar contracts.
And I don't think there was any argument at the time. No. I think, you know, everybody assumes, you know, that would be the case. Kaká was, you know, arguably the best player in the world at the time. And, you know, it wasn't a surprise that him and Ronaldo, they were signing the new Galacticos, weren't they? And those two were there. But whenever I do work for Sky now and Real Madrid, I look at full season Ronaldo and you go through all these goals each season. And you go through Kaká and there's barely anything there. He's suffered with injuries. And then since Jose Mourinho has taken over, he's just not his cup of tea. And because of his expensive wages, it's really difficult for other clubs to sign him. Real Madrid obviously don't want to be paying the majority of his contract. And I think he's not been too desperate to leave. So he's been quite happy to play second fiddle, which is a real shame, I think. We forget now, but when they made those signings, Ronaldo and Kaká, you know, everyone was pretty excited to see the play together. But he, again, is another one of those players that Real Madrid have got so many of that if they all click going forward, they could do that to any team in the world. And they've got six or seven attacking players, whichever four or five he picks to play, they could, you know, really take anyone to the cleaners.
I was in the Bernabeu.
I think they've only got one good defender.
Yeah. Who?
And that's Ramos.
Yeah.
And I mean, Pepe is out injured at the moment. I hope he plays. Because he's always got a mistake in him, and it's always a costly mistake against the better teams, better strikers. Marcelo is good going forward, but Barcelona know he's a weakness when they play them and attack it down that flank. And I think Arbeloa is okay. I think when they signed Modric, I was thinking they needed a defender more than spending 30-odd million on a player that they didn't really need. And, you know, I thought there was room for them if they really wanted to strengthen. I couldn't see how they possibly could do it with the attacking players and the attacking midfield players. But I looked at that back before and I thought they should have better than that. And they haven't strengthened the back four. Varane is a really good young player, but that's what he is. So, you know, tested at the top flight against the Rooney's and Van Persie's and Hernandez is, you know, he might be a little bit too much for him at the moment, but I'm sure he looks like he's been a really good player. But I think United could get at that back four as long as they're not 2 or 3 nil down in the first hour. Tottenham did the same. They went there. Champions League a couple of years ago, and I actually spoke to a few people at Spurs and said, you'll be all right, first leg. Just avoid any disasters. Peter Crouch got sent off after about 5 minutes, and I think it was game over after 15 minutes, about 3-0 already. So they can do that with Real Madrid. But if you can avoid that and get over that, if you can get to half-time just a one goal behind or 0-0 and you're still very much in the game, it's competitive, you can get a spillover now of frustration from that stadium.
Yeah,
they're looking to turn against the manager.
Yeah, well, they've turned in many games. I was at the Manchester City game in September, and Madrid, when you're in the Bernabeu, there's this demand that you have to attack. They just won't accept anything less than that. And they dominated against City in the first half, in the second half, but they couldn't score. They went behind twice, and Ronaldo got the winner in the last minute. But there was this inevitability about the whole thing. Madrid have always got the players to beat even the best sides. And City went there as champions of England and were completely dominated, even though they scored twice and they only got beat 3-2. And the second point is, you mentioned the defence. Of course, the goalkeeper as well, Iker Casillas, arguably the best goalkeeper in the world, he's fallen out with Mourinho. He's not being picked either. That could be another big problem for Madrid.
Well, it is, because every week we're working at Sky now, we don't know who's going to be in goal.
Yeah.
And
nobody knows. 10 minutes before the game, there's only seems to be Mourinho who knows. Until that team sheet goes in, nobody knows.
It's absolutely. I don't see any change in form for Iker Casillas this season to any other season. He clearly isn't the problem. He isn't the reason why they've been struggling so much this season.
No.
But there is. Oh, I think we all know there's an issue between, particularly Ramos and Casillas. They've both been left out this season.
Yeah.
Both didn't deserve to be left out. We know the issue between them and the manager. And
it's a personal issue. It's many former managers have found out that there's a clique in the dressing room because of the some of the players are so powerful. And Casillas is the captain of his club, he's the captain of his country, who are world champions. I don't think he's an egotistical person. I've interviewed him, I think he seems perfectly normal. But Mourinho wants absolute power there, and this is his way of getting it, by showing his boss.
He's had a fight with everybody at that club to get power. And he's almost got all of it now.
Yeah, well, he's won most of the battles, but
it's
hard going up against Casillas because he's so popular. He's far more popular than Mourinho is with the people who pay his wages. Yeah.
And Ramos didn't come through Real Madrid, but he's been there long enough now and joined when he was young enough that they do see him as a potentially genuine Real Madrid legend now.
Yeah.
And it's almost like he knows what's going to happen if he does it. And he did it to Ramos earlier in the season and now to Casillas. And Casillas, to me, doesn't seem to be the type of professional that needed a kick out the backside.
Yeah.
As I said, I haven't seen any downturn in his form. He's not the reason they're dropping points. But there's loads of little stories. There is a clique because they're Spanish and there's meant to be a clique of Portuguese people at the club that the Spanish don't like. It goes back to the bad feeling in the Clásicos when Xavi and Ramos and Puyol and one or two others from Barcelona got together and they obviously wanted to calm everything down. Jose Mourinho didn't like that when he heard about that. Sharing a plane, wasn't it, to go to an awards ceremony with a couple of Barcelona players as well.
Yeah, that started happening.
Pathetic things like that you really should be above that when you're manager of Real Madrid, and you should expect certain things. But I must say, I'm not a Jose Mourinho lover. I'm not a big fan. I'm watching the games now and I'm seeing Real Madrid get outplayed by really inferior teams in terms of possession.
Osasuna.
Real Madrid have got players in attack that within two or three passes can go the length of the pitch and score a goal against the run of play.
And that's always a danger against Manchester United. I can remember going to the Bernabeu. In 2000, United were the reigning European champions, the treble winners. Madrid were not playing well. United went there as favourites. I can remember the mood in the city before the game, what everybody was writing in Marca and AS. And Madrid went through. United got a 0-0 draw in the Bernabeu, but back at Old Trafford, Redondo was incredible. And they've got that magic. They can do it. Even when things are going against them, they've still got arguably better players than any club in the world, technically.
Yeah,
exactly.
The Galacticos, perfect example. That team was prior to the Galacticos. And when you see them now, as I said, Andy, they're not playing well, but also Ronaldo will get it around 60 yards. You play a little 1-2 Brazil, slip Benzema or Higuain, and there's straight away there's three, four players. Add Di Maria into that. And you talk about real top-class players. But they're a team purely that rely on individual talent, brilliant individual talent. But that's why I say that my argument against Jose Mourinho is there isn't a style of play there from Real Madrid. They're not interested in possession. He tries to keep the back four reasonably solid. He will allow the left back to push forward. The midfield too, Xabi Alonso doesn't really go anywhere apart from sitting in front of the two central defenders. And Sami Khedira, I think, has been possibly one of their best players this season. He's been a real sort of all-action midfield player that's defending. We used to think he was just sitting there with Xabi Alonso, but he's not. He's really pushing on his career at Real Madrid. And but when you get those, the Khedira, Ozil, Di Maria, Ronaldo, Benzema, Higuain, clicking, they don't have to be playing well. They can just, between two or three of them, conjure up a goal. Or in Ronaldo's case, he can do it all on his own.
Yeah.
So that's how Real Madrid are at the moment. And I went on the cup match the other night against Valencia. they were totally outplayed and 1-2-0 at home. Valencia even dominated possession, created chances, should have had a couple of referee decisions that didn't go their way, but against the run of play, Real Madrid go from one end of the pitch and score a goal.
I also think Valencia are incapable of winning away this season. It's just the mad. They did won once up until, I think they played at Granada just before Christmas, just after Christmas.
They, I mean, they should have had to believe there. I mean, they had a couple of really good chances as well. But they, like most teams that go to the Bernabeu, and they're not sure they really believe that they can win before, you know, you've lost and you accept it again. But that's been the case, that, you know, on a lot of occasions this year, Real Madrid are good. I mean, their record at home is almost perfect. It's away from home, they've got all their points in the league. You know, they've only drawn with Valencia at home in the league. The rest of it is, you know, almost perfect. So that's another thing that I'm sure is running through. So I can't wait for those games. As soon as the draw was made, I said, you know, I can't wait for those two games.
I can't either. And United fans are really up for it. We've been given just short of 4,000 tickets, but there's a lot more going over there, and everyone's saying, how do we get tickets? How do we get into the Bernabeu? I know that Martin Ferguson, Sir Alex's brother, he's been watching every Madrid game, watching them closely, looking for little way through and a solution to the problem, but I can't wait for it. It's interesting talking about the current Madrid team, but I'd like to wind back 30 years now to when you were playing. You weren't playing for Madrid, but you were highly rated in England. You were playing for Tottenham. You moved to Coventry, who were a good side then, certainly not the club who was struggling now. You scored a hat-trick against Liverpool. Do you remember that one?
Oh, of course, yep, December the 10th, 1983.
That must have been a buzz, because Liverpool were the main men.
It was the first time I'd ever played against them. It was my first game ever against Liverpool. Everything was perfect about that day, because I'd left Tottenham, didn't really want to be honest. I wanted to start the club. But it was similar, you know, to Manchester United at the time. Big name players kept being signed in my position. I'd been offered a 1-year contract with a £50 a week rise, and Coventry offered me 3 years without the £50 rise. So I spoke to Bobby Gould, and he said that he wanted me to go straight into the first team, and that was it for me. I wanted to do that. That's what I wanted to be, a regular first team player at 20 years of age. And I've played 20 odd games for Tottenham the year before, but never really felt as if I was a first-choice player. And of course, I wasn't at that age, but, you know, I thought I'd done enough to more than just a one-year deal. And then I went Coventry, and things started off really well. The season started off well for us. I think we were going into the game into Liverpool, we were fourth. We had a brand-new team. It's the whole team had left from the year before. When I went out to sign for Coventry with Bobby Gould, I went for Chatlin to the training ground, and there was a small group of about 7 or 8 players playing. And this was the week the season was starting. And Gouldie had not long had the job, and Dave Sexton had just left, and a lot of the players left with him. And Gouldie said, look, I need an answer in 10 minutes, because that's all I've got out there, and we ain't got enough for a game on Saturday at Watford. So it was amazing. We all signed, new players signed, and we're all living in a hotel in Coventry together. And then when we come to play in Liverpool, we're fourth. My first time playing against Liverpool, a lot of our players had been signed from lower leagues. And we were on Match of the Day, which was a rarity for Coventry City. Not all the games were shown back then. So everything was set up. Everything was perfect. And we raced into a 3-0 lead in the first half. And I was lucky to get a couple. And then, you know, we completed in the second half. And towards the end of the game, I got my hat-trick. And we went out 4-0 winners with it. You're right, that was the team at the time. They won the European Cup that season. They won the league again, which they did most years. It was the Dalglish and Rush and Graham Souness and Alan Hansen, Mike Lawrence and Phil Neils, and Bruce Grobbelaar. It was the team. And, you know, for me to do that, I was 20 years old, was absolutely amazing. And I had some good times at Coventry. It was good. I wanted to prove that I could play in the top flight on a regular basis in my position that I wanted to play, and got 50-odd goals in 2.5 seasons.
You did very well, and your ratio was good, and it was enough to attract Manchester United in 1986. Ron Atkinson came in for you. How did you feel? How did the move come about?
It came about, Peter Barnes rang me. Barnesy was at Coventry with us, and Barnesy couldn't get a game at Coventry, and then one day comes in and says, I'm off to Man United. And we thought, well, look, to, you know, in the, can't be nuts to play for Man United. He said, no, they've come in from now off. We were like, what? He couldn't play for us and Old Trafford. He went there and did well as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, in Coventry he didn't get many games, and he was the first choice. He was with the type of team that probably couldn't afford to have a luxury left winger. Barnsley was that. I mean, he was fantastic on the ball, and it suited him to play for Manchester United more than it clearly did for Coventry, because when he went to United, he did really well. And Barnsley rang me, and he said, Ron wants to know, would you be interested in joining Manchester United? Of course.
Yeah.
And that was the sort of first I heard of it, and it took about 2 weeks. I didn't hear anything else. And then one day after training, I actually knew that the last game I played for Coventry was against Everton, and I scored a really good goal. And there was an injury just in the first half, quite early on in the game, and the bench was just under the director's box at Coventry. So there was some instructions coming from the bench, Don McCartney's the manager. And as I looked across, you could see Ron turning up. He was late, and he was walking down the stairs at the director's box.
Big entrance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and he might have had a fur coat on. And I looked across and saw him, and I already knew about the interest. And, you know, I just wondered then whether he was there to watch me or not. And you're hoping and wishing it would all work out. And luckily for me, it did. And he signed me after that game.
So how did the wages compare to Coventry?
They doubled my money. And that was it. That was the only negotiation needed. I was on £350 a week at Coventry, and Manchester United asked me that. I should have said about £400 or £500, and then I spent well double that. And that was it. That's all it took. To be honest, if they've offered me the £350, I would sign.
So how do you look back at your time at United? You were only there a couple of years. You played 23 games in total, 15 starts.
I still, now 50 years old now, and it still frustrates me. You know, desperately frustrated and annoyed. I went there, that would have been January.
1986. There's a bit of background for people who don't know. You went in January 86. Mark Hughes, who was the main man, the top scorer, the hero, he'd agreed to move to Barcelona that summer. Not that United were making that public, and you came in as a striker, possibly to be seen as a replacement for Hughes.
That boy's pressure. It didn't bother me. I was not phased at all, because of playing for Spurs, which was a big club, not as big as Manchester United, I'll grant you that, and I'm a Spurs supporter, and Teddy Sheringham said exactly the same as other players that have played for the two, and it is different, but Tottenham is one of the genuine big clubs in the country, and I wasn't phased by going to Old Trafford. In fact, I couldn't wait to get going. I think the background as well was the team had started off that season with 10 straight wins. By the time I got there in January, they were in second. And I felt I'd got 14 goals for Coventry, which was more than United players had got. And I felt that I genuinely could get the goals that could get United back to the top of the league again and keep it there in my first season. So I was full of confidence when I went there. I wouldn't say I expected to start straight away, but because of the background, because of there was an issue with people scoring goals, Mark Hughes had, I was going to Barcelona, I did reasonably think that the manager had brought me to use me straight away. But that wasn't the case. It ended up, my home debut took me a year. That's my first start at home, was a year later. So it was frustrating that I never got any momentum from the start, and to sort of create a good first impression and some appearance here and there. Three away games over that first year as well, and that's it really. So that it really does fill me with frustration, because I know that I could have done a job if the club, the manager, had the belief to allow me to play, you know, full of confidence. Look at it, on the face value, I'm scoring 14 goals for a team that's struggling at the bottom of the league. I go to a club that's got a chance of winning the league, better players, winning more games, and it should have all fell into place to do that. You need to play, and if you're not starting games, then it's not going to happen. You lose that momentum. I lost the confidence, lost a bit of self-esteem. There was an issue between me and the manager that was never going to get better. And to this day, it'll be 27 years later, it still frustrates the life out of me.
I can understand everything you've said there. I went to Bromsgrove to see Ron Atkinson as part of my 80s book on United, and I know you read that and you wanted to put the record straight. Ron Atkinson said he decided to get rid of Alan Brazil, who was getting a lot of abuse from the United fans. He'd arranged to swap Brazil for Cyril Regis at Coventry, but he said that the move was sabotaged by an injury scare, with our medical experts insisting it was too risky to take Regis on board. So Ron said, in the end, our transaction revolved around Terry Gibson. I considered his pace might provide attacking variation for us. It was a theory that never had a chance to prove itself. In truth, the whole scene was too big for Terry. He couldn't handle it. And if I had to hold my hands up, the transfer gamble failed. That seems a bit harsh, that.
It's harsh and totally untrue,
yeah.
I mean, as well. I mean, there was no... Ron had a relationship with Cyril.
Yeah.
Back to the West Brom days. Cyril was having a really poor time. At that time of his Coventry career, it hadn't worked out. The year before, I'd got 19, Cyril got 5. That season, I'd got 14. I think Cyril had 6, and 5 were in one game against Chester. So I was the one player scoring goals at United. Ron did have said that since. He said it to me not long after I'd signed for the club. Without me playing, I think I'd come on as a sub somewhere, and he blames me for not scoring a goal. I mean, I knew I'd picked the wrong player. I should have called Big Cyril instead of you. And I remember saying to him, how the expletive did you get the two of us mixed up? Footballer. And the obvious differences between a player like Cyril and a player like me. And he was just... He thought he was being funny, but it was an attempt to put me down. And he did throw it at me a few times. But how did you get the two of us mixed up? I mean, and I said to him, actually said, yeah, you bought the wrong player, you bought the one that scored all the goals.
Good and for you, sticking up for yourself.
He thought it was an easy way to be a bully. I found Ron a bully.
Yeah.
Didn't ever come across any endearing traits of his personality. As a person, I certainly didn't see anything as a manager. And I look back now with more experience and think, you know, what he did at training and was just an absolute farce for a club like Manchester United.
Where did you live in Manchester? Were there any bright spots about living there? Any highlights playing for the team?
Oh, I loved it. No, listen, Andy, I loved every minute that I played for Manchester United. It wasn't enough. That was the problem. The players were fantastic. I was fortunate to be around an infamous group of players, shall we say, that had a reputation on and off the pitch. I was there when Sir Alex Ferguson first came to the club. I don't regret for one second my decision to sign for Manchester United above Tottenham. It was a chance I had to take, and I loved every single minute. I loved every single minute of being a Manchester United player. It was just that I wanted more of them. And didn't get them, but you know the players were great, and that was quite a nice. You know, when I'm writing my book at the moment, and I've looked back at that period, and there's some of the players, all the players, no exceptions, were really supportive of my situation. You know, it can be difficult when a new player goes to a new club. You need a good start, you don't get it, and then all of a sudden that sort of indifferent start becomes an absolute disaster. But there was the players were nothing but supportive, and then it was a difficult time for me. People like Brian Robson, the obvious ones, Gordon Strachan, Paul McGrath, Kevin Moore, and Norman Whiteside, Frank, Arthur Augustin, Mickey Duxbury. They were really good lads. And as I said, they were supportive. And delighted when I scored my one and only goal for Manchester United at the Stratford end against Arsenal. That was my debut, my home debut. It was a year after the time. And I, as I said, I obviously come with a sub that started the game, and that was under Sir Alex Ferguson. So Ron said that Manchester United and Old Trafford was too big for me. I had to laugh when I saw that comment because I'd never played there for them. I'd scored goals against United at Old Trafford, but he never gave me the chance to do that in a red shirt. So the players were great. We had, you know, some charismatic players on and off the pitch. And
like who?
Up with a whole lot. I mean, it was an eye-opener. I mean, again, it was similar to Spurs. Spurs had the senior players, and you looked up to them. And, you know, when I joined United, I was still only 23. So it was my third club at 23 years of age. But, you know, you see the likes of Norman, Paul, John Gidman, you know, Kevin Moran, and Jesper Olsen as well, and Strack. It was, you know, they were great times. As I said, I would love the opportunity to have played with them more. There was quite a gang of us actually that weren't involved on a regular basis, and that's all your weekly routine, and moaning about the manager, moaning about life in general, and you know, trying to turn things round. But it was different back then. There was no rotation. There wasn't big squads taken to games. There was only one sub, maybe two subs, when it changed during my time at United. So it was a group of us, the Sour Grapes gang, sort of sticking together, and it was the team spirit was actually off the pitch was fantastic.
Where did you go out? Where did you live?
We lived at Wilmslow, and I must admit I wasn't a big drinker. So and if I'd have even attempted to have gone the pace, gone the distance with that lot, I would have been in serious trouble. I think I was bad at United measures, but what I'd been like if I'd gone out with Norman and Brahms and
a few of them said they'd try and stand the pace with him, and they were just completely out the depth, just totally dazed. Gary Bailey, it wasn't everyone's cup of tea there, but he just said he tried to go toe-to-toe with him one night, and he just had to see a doctor. I got an email off Norman this morning. He wanted a good recommendation for a tapas bar in Barcelona. So he's still loving life, as you can see off his Twitter feed. It revolves around, you know, the good things in life.
I was moved up there, I was living in the hotel, which the players loved. I was staying in the Portland in central London with Colin Gibson. He was there as well.
In the centre of Manchester, yeah.
John Severbeck signed as well, so there was three of us there. And it was so different to my Coventry. When I went to Coventry, I went to the hotel, I paid for all my phone calls, all my meals. I think I got breakfast, that was it. I went to United. And I was signing bills left, right and centre for sunbeds, beauty treatment, Calvary's, every day. No questions were asked. I could eat. I ended up getting fed up with food in the hotel. You end up smuggling a Kentucky Fried Chicken in the lift and stuff like that. And I was thinking, who's this? And the players were ringing me up saying, give a room in town. Can we pop in your hotel and put a meal on your bill? So players were coming in. Wives were having some beds and whatever. They were all having a Calvary and everything was going on my bill. Colin Gibson's bill and John Suverbeck's. Nothing was ever mentioned, and that's how it was. I remember going in while I was in the hotel, going into training. I'd had a cook's breakfast, which I wouldn't do at home, but you're living in a hotel, there's a fry up available on the way down to when you go to training, so you have a quick fry up. We go to training, we're running around the cliff, it's a running session. Now, I'm not particularly worried, I'm not great at running. Long distance running was not my bag, but I'm not concerned that I've had a fry-up when I look at the state of some of the others who have been on an all-nighter. So we get to we're at the cliff, we go out training. Ron comes out, we've got to do a 12-minute run. That means you do as many laps as you can of the cliff in 12 minutes. And I know I'm going to be middle pretty much at the back. Robbo, who's been on the all-nighter, is lapping us after about three or four laps. And I'm thinking, what have I done wrong? I've had a fry-up. I can't be that bad. I ended up being sick, trying to keep up the pace of some of the really good runners. And I'm on the floor, my hands and knees, being sick behind the goal at the cliff. One comes over and he says, have you been out with that lot? And I went, no, I've had a bit of a fry up at the hotel. Robbo's lapping everyone. I must admit, no one and Paul weren't as good at covering it up as Robbo. But it was amazing that he could do that, come in and, you know, a 12-minute run where he would do 12 laps.
A freak of...
Everyone else is doing about eight.
A freak of nature, Robbo. Everybody says that about him. So how did Sir Alex Ferguson change all that?
Everything changed. Nothing was the same. On away trips, that was the first thing I noticed, that you had to report for evening meal in a hotel away together. In the past, it had been eat what you like, wherever you like, room service and stuff. There was a set menu now, in the evening, set menu for pre-match meal. There was, you had to be out on the training ground at the time, you know, to be training. You didn't drift out and drips and drabs, knowing that if it started at 10:30, the manager wasn't going to be out till 10:45, so he sort of meandered your way out. Everyone knew under Sir Alex Ferguson that 10:01 start, if you weren't out there, when he came out just before 10:01, you were in trouble. And he treated everybody the same. I always felt there was a group on the run that no matter what they did, how they played and the football, you know, on a Saturday, that they would play. And I wasn't alone in thinking that. There was, you know, 7 or 8 players that no matter what the situation was, how they played, it just wouldn't change. And then there was another sort of 15 players that were rotated in sort of 3 or 4 of you each week, every now and then would get a game. So I think when the new manager comes, anyway, any club, all the players that are not involved will probably believe that they've got a chance of, you know, starting afresh again. But there was huge differences. I mean, with Ron, it was 5-a-side every day, bit of shooting practice, and it was almost, you know, not comical, really. I mean, there was no fitness, very little fitness work involved, very little preparation in terms of the opposition involved. Ron didn't like to name his team until last minute, so that obviously a group of disappointed players won't be around the club, affecting preparations. But with Alex Ferguson, everything changed from day one. You had to be out on time and training. I remember one of the first things at half time that you had to run in sprinting to the change room at half time. It looked bizarre at the time, and because you didn't want to not do it, because you knew immediately, we knew that you were going to get a rollicking off of him and Archie Knox. So there was loads of little differences that made a big difference, and professionalism. It was more like a normal routine that I'd had at Spurs and some of the managers at Coventry. So it wasn't a great change, but compared to Ron's relaxed manner of managing, it was a massive change.
You didn't feature in Fergie's long-term plans. How did he break the news that you were to leave Manchester United, or did somebody come in for you? Did Wimbledon come in for you?
No, I asked for transfer.
Yeah.
I knew it was 18 months, and I'd spent too many Saturday afternoons sitting home listening to the game on the radio, not being involved, too many games watching in the stand at Old Trafford. Fergie, to be honest, gave me more of a chance than Ron. And I have to be honest, I didn't take it. I think that goes back to what I was saying earlier, that I didn't get momentum when I started. You need a good start. When I joined Coventry, I got to a good start and just continued. At Old Trafford, I didn't get that. And then with the new manager, there was a daily speculation on who was coming, who was going, and I was always in the list of players going. It was quite a long list. Mark Hughes was coming back. Brian McClair was joining the club. Sir Alex Ferguson had given me opportunities. I'd taken a few, but by that time I knew I was not going to be at Manchester United on a long-term basis, and decided to cut my losses at the end of the season, so I sold my house, asked for a transfer, and then went back pre-season to Manchester United, and then Bobby Gould took over Coventry at Wimbledon, and Bobby Gould had bought me at Coventry, and then he got in touch. It was quite funny, because Bob got in touch with me after his children took over at Wimbledon, and he knew that I was, you know, going to leave Manchester United. And now, so I'd be interested. I said, yeah, of course I would. So he explained straight away the wages were going to be half of what I was earning again at Old Trafford, which I didn't mind on first team football. I went in to see Alex Ferguson after we'd had a bit of a disagreement over a reserve game, and I'd threatened to pack up football. I was that low. And we went out, actually, a reserve game at Chesterfield against their first team. And I think it was me and John Sealerbeck were the only two senior pros. The rest were really young. It was people like Tony Hill, Lee Martin, Nicky Wood, all that age group. And we drove across to Chesterfield, got stuck in traffic. When we got there, it was their first team. And we got there literally on kickoff time. So we had to run off, change quick, and it was full up. The ground was full up. It was pre-season friendly. And we went into 3-0 deficit straight away. Playing in senior pros, with not too many in our team. Anyway, we're coming at half-time, 3-0 down. We won the game in the end, 4-3 in the second half. We got four goals back, got the winner in the last minute. We sort of rallied. We had better players, of course, but they were young. And Fergie called us in the training the next day as a group. And I think he was going to say, well done, because it was a really good effort against a senior team. In front of a big crowd, and at the time it was the biggest crowd some of those young boys had played in, and they absolutely slaughtered us. Mm. Called out the attitude of disgrace, and there was no coaching there. Brian Whitehouse was the coach. He wasn't involved in the meeting in Fergie's office. And there was only me and John Sealerbeck were the two senior ones. I knew them. I was leaving then. And I stood up and had a row with the manager and stormed out. And basically shoved the job, shoved the football career, and that was it. I was packing up. Went off, and Mark Hughes and Clayton Blackmore calmed me down. Spent the afternoon with me, telling me not to be so stupid. And I knew within half an hour walking away from the cliff that I didn't mean it. So I had to go in the next morning and swallow it and knock on the manager's door and tell him I'm sorry and apologise. And to be honest, it was good as gold. I went in a little bit nervous because I didn't know him that well by then. And he just laughed. And he went, I love your spirit, son. And he said, it's probably gallbanger. So I went, no. He went, swear on your daughter's life, Bobby Gould has a rang you. I went, I can't do that. And he went, go out, tell him I want $200,000 and you can go. So we parted on really good terms. Although I was at the row, he said he liked my spirit, and he said that's since as well. But he obviously knew that Bobby Gould had rang me as well.
We've only got a couple more minutes left. You went to Wimbledon. Maybe not an obvious choice for Wimbledon, given that they had a lot of bigger players. A Wimbledon side who would become infamous for the spirit on and off the pitch. Was there any inauguration ceremonies when you arrived there?
No, there wasn't. And you know what? There was a touch of bullying. There was a heavy mob that were there. There was half a dozen new players that had joined, and I was one of those. The other players were like Terry Feegan, who came from Swansea, John Scales from Bristol Rovers. Eric Young came from Brighton, Clyde Goodyear, Plymouth. And they went through, I have to be honest, it was a bullying campaign. They didn't like the fact that we were new, the manager was new, the fashion news, Vinnie Jones, Sanchez, and that little lot. They didn't like the fact that Nigel Winterburn had left, Glenn Hodges had left. There was one or two other players that had left, and they resented us being there. I got away with it because I'd come from Man United and because I'd been at Spurs and Coventry. But the other ones really did go for it. It wasn't an initiation process where it was one day. They had 6 months of it.
How did the bullying manifest itself?
Abusive in training, abusive in games. There was an abuse thrown at them in terms of blame if we didn't win games. If they made mistakes, I can remember Wally Downs throwing a pair of boots at John Scales. And it was at the end of a reserve game. So it was a real process that we all had to... I got away with it. And I would say probably Eric Young got away with it because of his size. But I know Terry Feegan and John Scales, and they really did get put through it.
Didn't Eric Young have his clothes set on fire?
Oh, yeah, I did that. That was his fault, though. You can't sign for Wimbledon. We had to take our own kit in every day. We had kit supplied, but we were responsible for washing it and stuff. And Youngie had a Michael Jackson Thriller leather jacket that he wore every single day. And he brought his kit to training every day in a Brighton and Hove Albion bag. So I set fire to that with Vinnie. It was actually so ridiculous when I think back. It was we set fire to it in the change room. Me and Vinny were injured having treatment, and we saw his bag, saw his leather jacket, chucked it all in the Brighton Hove Albion. It was made like a rubber bag. It was awful. Put it in the bag. We tried to set fire to it in the changing room. Can you believe that? And it wouldn't work. So we got yellow pages and started ripping up the yellow pages and filling the bag up because we couldn't get the rubber and the leather alight. Rubber from the bag and leather from his jacket. So we stuffed the bag full of yellow pages. And that got it going, of course. And then next thing you know, the change room's catching on fire. And Vinny had to pick the bag up in the middle of the change room floor and throw it out the window. Eric, we had the fire engines turn up and everything, because it nearly did spread.
What did Eric say?
He said that he was doing some extra heading, and when he came back in after training, everyone else was laughing. You could smell the burning. You'd see the fire engines turn up. He didn't think, you wouldn't think, oh, it's my clothes and my bag and jacket got up in flames. When he came back, all we'd found, all that was left was the handles from the bag. So we hung the handles on his hook. So when he came back in, he said, what's going on here? He smelled the smell and everything. He walked in the change and there's just the two rubber handles hanging on his bag. The rest of it was in a pile out on the grass outside the window. He laughed.
And yet you won the FA Cup, again, beating Liverpool.
Yeah, honestly, once we'd got over that stage, it was the fifth round, I think, at Newcastle, where coming back after that journey, I think we the new lot had been truly accepted. Up until that point, it was the old lot against the new lot. It wasn't a great atmosphere, I've got to be honest. It was even Bobby and Donnell were in that disagreement as well. Anyone that was new at the club wasn't taken to by the old lot. I think they thought we were going to try and change everything. They thought the manager was going to change the style of play and you know, the atmosphere around the place, and that wasn't the case. And I think when we beat Newcastle away in the cup, I think they all realised that. We had a really good train ride home. Everybody was together, and that was the first time I noticed that. Before that, it had been a them and us, and they were always whinging about we weren't as good or the new lot weren't as good as the old lot, and they wanted Dave Bassett back, and they didn't accept Goldie. But after that game, it was clear, I think we'd earned trust and they'd accepted us. And from then on, we were really good. We had really good players. Some of those players I mentioned, you know, Terry Feeden and John Scales went on to have great careers. At the time, we were underestimated because they were still making their name in football and making it a club that, I've got to be honest, teams, supporters, people didn't like. We were underdogs in the final against Wimbledon, and people look on it back now with fond memories, but people hated us at the time. I remember the headlines, I've got the headlines, still got the papers, and everybody in the country wanted us to get beat, and none to get beat, they wanted us to get thrashed. So I laugh now when people look back and go, oh, Wimbledon, yeah, I wanted to, Wimbledon. They didn't. No one wanted us to win. Even though we were underdogs, people really wanted us to get beat 5 or 6 nil. They wanted us to see us humiliated because we weren't great for football. We were great for each other. We were great for Wimbledon and the Wimbledon supporters, but the way we played wasn't great to watch. Our method of playing sometimes crossed the line. But it got the job done, and I think people look back now fondly because we were so different, and different to modern day football as well. And, you know, we drove our own cars to the games and stuff like that, to away matches, and you know, silly things like that that over time is endeared to people. But believe me, at that stage, everybody wanted us to get beat and lose heavily against Liverpool, which we didn't.
Famously didn't. I don't think anybody in Manchester wanted you to lose that day against Liverpool, if that's really any not. Consolation.
Well, it was just the feeling we woke up the day of the final, and the headlines was, for the sake of football, Liverpool, you know, do this to this lot. And it was every paper. Most of the crowd at Wembley were Liverpool supporters, obviously. But we weren't a large club, and despite the fans, I said we were a small club, no resources. We were the underdogs, but we always felt that, you know, we got booed at every game we played at, so it didn't bother us if we got booed when we was at Wembley in the cup final.
Lovely stories, and great to speak to you. I'd love to carry on, but we do have a time limit on this. It's already been the longest podcast that we've done. So thank you. Good luck with everything. It's good that you're doing well and you've had a decent career, still involved in football after playing football. Finally, make a prediction for the game at White Hart Lane between United and Tottenham.
I actually think United away, but I mentioned I'd win now. I think this Man United don't go out for revenge, they go out to get 3 points, and I think they're in a good run of form. Pretty clean bill of health when it comes to injuries now, which is getting better. And again, it's still a place where Man United do well at, so I expect a really good game. I think we always do between these two teams over the years, but I'm down for Man United away win.
So that's it for this week's United We Stand podcast. We've got some decent guests lined up over the next few weeks, especially relating to Real Madrid and the games there in February, the one at Old Trafford in March. The new United We Stand is out with Raphael on the cover. He liked the cover so much that he put it on his Instagram account this week. So that was nice to see. If you can't get it at a game, we'll be selling them at Old Trafford, then you can download a digital edition through the United We Stand app, which is on iTunes. Or if you're on Android, go through our website and you can sort it out that way. Until next week, goodbye.